Ashwapati's being has been overpowered by the presence of the Divine Mother. All aims were lost in her and then found in her. And then begins the next para. Thus was a seed cast into endless time. This encounter between the aspiring Ashwapati and the Divine Presence has created a stir, cast a seed into eternal time, which is to fructify later in the fullness of things. A word is spoken. Do you hear that? You hear?
Yes.
A word is spoken, or a light is shown, a moment cease, the ages toil to express. Such are the seeds in creation which are cast in a second, in a moment. But it takes centuries for the fruit to appear. A word, a creative word, it goes on generating its own creative vibrations. Or a light is shown, showing the direction in which humanity has to pass, or a sight, a revealing sight is given in a moment, and it is ages. Holkar means. Ages toil to express. So, flashing out to the timeless, leaped the worlds. That is, he describes how all our worlds have leaped out from the being of the eternal in a moment. An eternal instant is the cause of the years. Years and ages work out what has been planted, what has been cast in one moment. Coming back to Ashwapati, all he had done was to prepare a field. All the mighty efforts of this king had only one meaning, that he had only prepared a field in which the seed has now been thrown. His small beginnings asked for a mighty end. The beginnings may have been small, but they were destined to have a great fruition. For all that he had been must now new shape in him, that is, all that he has been must now formulate itself in a new form. In other words, he has to new create himself in order her joy to embody, to be able to hold and radiate her joy, to enshrine her beauty and greatness in his house of life, to enshrine, to give a home to her beauty and greatness in his dwelling, required that he recreate himself. But now his being was too wide for self, that is, he has grown so much that his former self looks pitifully small, too small to occupy his enlarged being. His heart's demand had grown immeasurable. The aspiration, the demand of his heart had become boundless. It was no longer confined to his personal self. His single freedom could not satisfy. Her light, her bliss, he asked for earth and men. He was not content with winning her light and her bliss for himself, but he wanted them for earth and men, for the terrestrial existence. But vain are human power and human love to break the earth's seal of ignorance and death. He may want, but his own power, his own love for earth and humanity are certainly not strong enough to break the seal of ignorance and death which holds the earth in slavery. His nature's might seemed now an infant's grasp. All his power, all his might now seems to be like the grasp of an infant. Heaven is too high for outstretched hands to seize. That is, human effort alone is not enough to effect the deliverance, to win the kingdom of God. Heaven is too high, man's outstretched hands cannot reach out there, it is too high. They cannot touch the heavens, let alone seize. This light comes not by struggle or by thought, by the struggle of our mind or vital, or by the thought. You cannot win this light. It has to come from there. The initiative is there, not here. In the mind's silence, the transcendent act. The transcendent reality acts only when the mind is silent. Otherwise, the mind is always occupied with its own noise, noise of the vital being. And the transcendent power doesn't get an opportunity to act. It needs the silence in the being. In the mind's silence, the transcendent acts, and a hushed heart hears the unuttered word. The word from above is not uttered as the human word is. It is not articulated by the tongue. Unuttered word, the silent word, but the hushed heart, the heart in which all the emotive movements have been hushed, silence for the time being, that hears the word from above, though it is not uttered. A vast surrender was his only strength. He refers to Ashwapati. His little human might was totally inadequate. He could only surrender in the vastness of his being. And what was evoked, that was his strength. A power that lives upon the heights must act, not a power that is raised from below. A power that lives upon the heights must act, bring into life's closed room the immortal's air, life's territory as it is like a closed room where there is no fresh breath, and it is only a power from the heights that can bring the immortal's air into this closed room and fill the finite with the infinite. Finite is our limited being. The infinite is the divine, is the spirit, and the finite has to be filled with the infinite. Now, it is only the power from above, he says, that must act. And this is the principle he has in mind when referring to Kundalini power that is raised from below. He says, in this integral yoga, instead of laboriously awakening and drawing up this power from nether regions, from the subconscious regions, upsetting all these nether regions, which had better be left to themselves, would it not be better to evoke the higher and the freer power from above to descend into the being and work in the system that is purer, more powerful, more effective? And it comes down from purer regions of existence. All that denies must be torn out and slain. All in us that denies the divine power, that denies the higher faith, must be torn out. I believe in the life divine he refers, torn out with its bleeding roots. Each desire that is pulled out causes some pain. But once it is pulled out, it no longer bothers. But if it is just suppressed, it may surge up any moment. So he says, all that denies must be torn out and slain, extirpated and crushed, the many longings, the many desire moments, for whose sake we lose the one for whom our lives were made. All our lives we are running after the fleeting desires which occupy all our time and energy, and in the pursuit of these longings we forget, we lose sight of the one, the him or her for whose sake our lives are made. The real object of life we forget. In our concerns for the fleeting objects of life, for the fleeting toys of life. Now he comes back to Ashwapati and says, now other claims had hushed in him their cry. Claims other than the claim for the divine power, the divine peace. All those petty desires, maybe for others, had hushed their cry. Only one longing remains, that is, only he longed to draw her presence and power into his heart and mind and breathing frame, the living body. Only he yearned to call forever down. There was only one yearning left, and that is to summon, to call her down with her healing touch of love and truth and joy. To call forever down, once for all, her healing touch. The touch that fulfills, the touch that heals the wounds of suffering and pain. Touch of love and truth and joy into the darkness of this suffering world. His soul was freed and given to her alone. It did not disappear. Because it was liberated, it did not cease to be. It was given to her alone. It did not seek for anything personal, individual. That ends the canto, and we move on to the next canto, the house of the spirit and the new creation. A mightier task remained than all he had done. He has done so much so till now, but what remains to be done is something mightier. To that he turned, from which all being comes, the source of all, the origin of all, he turns. A sign attending from the secrecy. There is some mystery above, some secrecy, of which he sees a sign, a symbol. And that secrecy, that mystery, which knows the truth and grasp behind our thoughts, behind our thoughts, however high, there is a truth that is veiled, that is not grasped by the mind, that is not grasped by our thoughts. But that secrecy, that mystery to which he is aiming, it knows the truth, and it guards the world with its all-seeing gaze. Because that is the regarding gaze, everything goes on. The world is guarded from ruin and destruction because of this overseeing gaze of the creative spirit. Having described what is there that he is moving towards, now the poet describes his own his condition, Ashwapati's condition. In the unapproachable stillness of his soul, he has taken his poise, his position, withdrawn from all outer movements, and he is stationed in the stillness of his soul. That stillness is unapproachable by normal feelings, by normal thoughts, by normal movements of life. In the unapproachable stillness of his soul, intense, he is not inert, he is not passive, but concentrated to a high degree, one-pointed, he has no other view, no other aim, monumental, like a statue, unmoving, grand, and yet lone. He is alone, aloof from everything else. Patient, he sat like an incarnate hope, like a hope that is embodied, hope that has taken form. Motionless, unmoving, immutable, on a pedestal of prayer. Prayer, that's the foundation, that is the platform, pedestal, on which the statue-like figure is sitting motionless. A strength he sought that was not yet on earth. His whole being is concentrated on bringing down a strength which has not so far come down on earth. Help from a power too great for mortal will. Mortal will, the human will, can never exercise that much power. The light of a truth now only seen afar. There is only a vision of the truth, but the light of the truth is not yet active here. A sanction from his high, omnipotent source. He is seeking a sanction, a word, yes, from his own source, which is all-powerful, omnipotent source. But from the appalling heights, there stooped no voice, there was no response. From those frightful, awful heights, no voice came down. The timeless lids were closed. Lids, the eyelids of the creative eye, they are still closed. No opening came. A neutral, helpless void oppressed the ears. The flow of time was oppressed by a void, a sense of voidness, which was neutral, had no preference, helpless, no aid. Now remember that all this has not happened continuously. Ashwapati is seeing, he is falling down prone, he is awaking, he is seeing the higher creation. The poet has described continuously, but it has taken, in terms of earthly time, it has taken long. That is why he says, a neutral, helpless void oppressed the ears. The passage of time has been oppressed. Why? He describes, in the texture of our bound humanity, he felt the stark resistance, huge and dumb. In the very structure, in the very texture of our humanity, there is a resistance which is huge and which is dumb. And where resistance of our inconscient and unseeing base foundation, this stubborn, mute rejection in life's depth, rejection of what is coming from above, the ignorant know in the origin of things. There is a negation, there is a negative factor which refuses consent, which refuses to collaborate with higher nature. Now, if this is so in the external universe, outer humanity, in his individual frame also, Ashwapati has the same resistance. He says, a veiled collaboration with the night. Something in him also, at some level, cooperates, collaborates with the dark element, which is the night. A veiled collaboration with the night, even in himself, survived and hid from his view. Still something in his earthly being kept its kinship with the inconscient whence it came. Something in his physical being, earthly being, kept its companionship, kept its relation with the inconscient from which his being derived. That is, both in the universe and in the individual, there is the resistance of the inconscient, which says no to the advent of the conscient, a darkness which denies the light. And it is because of this ignorant no that there is a stark resistance, huge and dumb, and that obstructs the free transit of the higher light and truth.